Americans do not belong to civil society, having never left a state of nature. Within 18th century political thought, women too existed outside the contract by which civil society was formed. From Massachusetts, Abigail Adams wrote to her husband John in March of 1776, wondering whether that might be remedied. "I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors," she began, alluding to the long train of abuses of men over women. "Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands," she told him. She spoke of tyranny. "Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could." And she challenged him to follow the logic of the principle of representation. "If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Her husband would have none of it. "As your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh," he replied. "We've been told that our struggle has loosened the bands of government everywhere, that children and apprentices were disobedient, that schools and colleges were grown turbulent, that Indians slighted their guardians, and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems." That women were left out of the nation's founding documents and out of its founders' idea of civil society, considered like slaves to be confined to a state of nature, would trouble the political order for centuries. At the Continental Congress in June, Pennsylvania delegate John Dickinson drafted the Articles of Confederation. "The name of this confederacy shall be the United States of America," he wrote, possibly using that phrase for the first time. It may be that Dickinson found the phrase, the United States, in a book of treaties used by Congress. It included a treaty from 1667 that referred to a confederation of independent Dutch states as the United States of the Low Countries. In Dickinson's draft, the colonies, now states, were to form a league of friendship for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare. The first draft brought before Congress called for each state's contribution to the costs of war and of the government to be proportionate to population, and therefore called for a census to be taken every 3 years. It would take many revisions and a year and a half of debate before Congress could agree on the final version. That final document stripped from Dickinson's original most of the powers his version had granted to Congress. The final Articles of Confederation are more like a peace treaty, establishing a defensive alliance among sovereign states than a constitution establishing a system of government. Much was makeshift. The provision for a census of all the states together, for instance, was struck in favor of an arrangement by which a common treasury was to be supplied in proportion to the value of all land within each state. And since in truth no one knew that value, what the states contributed would be left for the states to decide. Nevertheless, these newly united states edged towards independence. On June 7, 1776, fiery Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee introduced a resolution that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. A vote on the resolution was postponed, but Congress appointed a committee of five to draft a declaration. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, New York delegate Robert R. Livingston, and Connecticut delegate Roger Sherman. Jefferson agreed to prepare a first draft. The Declaration of Independence was not a declaration of war. The war had begun more than a year before. It was an act of state, meant to have force within the law of nations. The Declaration explained what the colonists were fighting for. It was an attempt to establish that the cause of the Revolution was that the king had placed his people under arbitrary power, reducing them to a state of slavery. "The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states." Many readers found these words unpersuasive. In 1776, the English philosopher and jurist Jeremy Bentham called the theory of government that informed the Declaration of Independence absurd and visionary. Its self-evident truths he deemed neither self-evident nor true. He considered them instead subversive of every actual or imaginable kind of government. But what Bentham found absurd and visionary represented the summation of centuries of political thought and political experimentation. "There is not an idea in it but what had been hackneyed in Congress for 2 years before," Adams later wrote, jealous of the acclaim that went to Jefferson. Jefferson admitted as much, pointing out that novelty had formed no part of his assignment. Of the Declaration, he declared, neither aiming at originality of principles or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind. But its ideas, those expressions of the American mind, were older still. "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable," Jefferson began, "that all men are created equal and independent, that from that equal creation they derive rights inherent and inalienable, among which are the preservation of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these ends governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government shall become destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government." He borrowed from and vastly improved upon the Virginia Declaration of Rights written by George Mason. Having established that a right of revolution exists if certain conditions are met, it remained to establish that those conditions obtained. The bulk of Jefferson's draft was a list of grievances, of charges against the king, calling him to account for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for dissolving the colonists' assemblies, for keeping a standing army, for depriving us of trial by jury, rights established as far back as Magna Carta. Then, in the longest statement in the draft, Jefferson blamed George III for African slavery, charging the king with waging cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery, preventing the colonies from outlawing the slave trade, and that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of a distinguished die, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms amongst us. This passage Congress struck, unwilling to conjure this assemblage of horrors in the nation's founding document. The declaration that Congress did adopt was a stunning rhetorical feat, an act of extraordinary political courage. It also marked a colossal failure of political will in holding back the tide of opposition to slavery by ignoring it for the sake of a union that, in the end, could not and would not last. In July, the Declaration of Independence was read aloud from townhouses and street corners. Crowds cheered, cannons were fired, church bells rang. Statues of the king were pulled down and melted for bullets. Weeks later, when a massive slave rebellion broke out in Jamaica, slave owners blamed the Americans for inciting it. In Pennsylvania, a wealthy merchant, passionately stirred by the spirit of the times, not only freed his slaves but vowed to spend the rest of his life tracking down those he had previously owned and sold, and their children, and buying their freedom. And in August of 1776, 1 month after delegates to the Continental Congress determined that in the course of human events it is sometimes necessary for one people to dissolve the bands which have connected them with another, Harry Washington declared his own independence by running away from Mount Vernon to fight with Dunmore's regiment, wearing a white sash stitched with the motto, "Liberty to Slaves." 3. During the war, nearly 1 in 5 slaves in the United States left their homes, fleeing American slavery in search of British liberty. One American refugee renamed himself British Freedom. New lyrics to Yankee Doodle, rewritten as "The Negro's Farewell to America," were composed in London. In the new version, fugitive slaves leave the United States for old England, where liberty reigns, where Negro no beaten nor loaded with chains. Not many succeeded in reaching the land where liberty reigned, or even in getting behind British battle lines. Instead, they were caught and punished. One slave owner who captured a 15-year-old girl who was heading for Dunmore's regiment punished her with 80 lashes and then poured hot ember into the gashes. However desperate and improbable a flight, it must have seemed a good bet. The shrewdest observers expected Britain to win the war, not least because the British began with 32,000 troops, disciplined and experienced, compared to Washington's 19,000, motley and unruly. An American victory appeared an absurdity. But the British regulars far from home suffered from a lack of supplies, and while William Howe, commander-in-chief of British forces, set his sights first on New York and next on Philadelphia, he found that his victories yielded him little. Unlike European nations, the United States had no established capital city whose capture would have led to an American surrender. More importantly, time and again Howe failed to press for a final, decisive defeat of the Americans, fearing the losses his own troops would sustain and the danger of heavy casualties when reinforcements were at such a distance. Then, too, Britain's forces were spread thin across the globe, waging the war on many fronts. For the British, the American Revolution formed merely one front in a much larger war, a war for empire, a world war. Like the French and Indian War, that war was chiefly fought in North America, but it spilled out elsewhere too, to West Africa, South Asia, the Mediterranean, and the Caribbean. In 1777, Howe captured Philadelphia, while to the north, the British commander John Burgoyne suffered a humiliating defeat at the Battle of Saratoga. This American victory helped John Jay, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin, serving as diplomats in France, to secure a vital treaty. In 1778, France entered the conflict as an ally of the United States, at which point Lord North, keen to protect Britain's much richer colonies in the Caribbean from French attack, considered simply abandoning the American theater. Spain joined the French-American alliance in 1779. Germany entered the conflict by supplying paid soldiers called by Americans Hessians. And partly because the Dutch had been supplying arms and ammunition to the Americans, Britain declared war on Holland in 1780. The involvement of France brought the fighting to the wealthy West Indies, where, beginning in 1778, the French captured the British colonies of Dominica, Grenada, St. Vincent, Montserrat, Tobago, St. Kitts, and Turks and Caicos. The cessation of trade between the mainland and the British Caribbean exacted another kind of toll on Britain's profitable sugar colonies. Africans starved to death. On Antigua alone, a fifth of the slave population died during the war. To Americans, the Revolutionary War was not a world war, but a civil war between those who favored independence and the many who did not. John Adams, offhand, guessed that 1 in 3 colonists remained loyal to the crown and another third hadn't quite decided, but Adams's guess did not begin to include the still greater number of loyalists whom the British counted among their allies, the entire population of American slaves, and nearly all Native American peoples. One reason the British continually failed to press their advantage was that they kept trying to change the field of fighting to a part of the colonies where they expected to find more loyalist support, not only among the merchants and lawyers and farmers who remained loyal to the crown, but among their African and Indian allies. The battle, Howe's successor Henry Clinton believed, was to gain the hearts and subdue the minds of America. That strategy failed. And when that strategy failed, Britain didn't so much lose America as abandon it. At first, the crown courted compliance. In 1778, the king sent commissioners authorized to offer to repeal all acts of parliament that had been opposed by the colonies since 1763. But when Congress demanded that the king recognize American independence, the commissioners refused. At this point, although Clinton held New York City and fighting continued to the west, the theater of war moved to the south. British ministers decided to make a priority of saving the wealthy Sugar Islands, to give up on the northern and middle mainland colonies, and to try to keep the southern colonies in order to restore the supply of food to the West Indies. Clinton captured Savannah, Georgia, in December 1778, and set his sights on Charleston, South Carolina, the largest city in the South. In Congress, this led to a debate about arming slaves. In May 1779, Congress proposed to enlist 3,000 slaves in South Carolina and Georgia, and to pay them with their freedom. "Your Negro battalion will never do," warned John Adams. "South Carolina would run out of their wits at the least hint of such a measure." He was entirely correct. The South Carolina legislature rejected the proposal, declaring, "We are much disgusted." Clinton captured Charleston in May of 1780. In 1781, in hopes of taking the Chesapeake, the British general Lord Cornwallis fortified Yorktown, Virginia, as a naval base. His troops were soon besieged and bombarded by a combination of French and American forces. The French were led by the dazzling Marquis de Lafayette, whose service to the Continental Army and impassioned advocacy of the American cause had included lobbying for French support. Cornwallis was vulnerable because British naval forces were occupied in the Caribbean. He surrendered on October 19th, not realizing that British forces were that very day sailing from New York to aid him. Cornwallis's defeat at Yorktown ended the fighting in North America, but it didn't end the war. The real end for Great Britain came in 1782 in the West Indies at the Battle of the Saints, when the British defeated a French and Spanish invasion of Jamaica, an outcome that testified not to the empire's weaknesses, but to its priorities. Britain kept the Caribbean, but gave up America. Not surprisingly, the terms of the peace proved as messy and sprawling as the war. Loyalists confronted the same decision as the empire itself, whether to give up on America. "To go or not to, is that the question?" One bit of Shakespearean doggerel went, "Whether 'tis best to trust the inclement sky or stay among the rebels and by our stay rouse up their keenest rage." Most, not near so indecisive as Hamlet, left if they could. 75,000, about one in every 40 people in the United States, evacuated with the British. They went to Britain and Canada, to the West Indies and India. They helped build the British Empire. "No news here but that of evacuation," one patriot wrote from New York. "Some look smiling, others melancholy, a third class mad." None were more desperate to escape the United States than the 15 to 20,000 ex-slaves who were part of that exodus, the largest emancipation in American history before Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. In July of 1783, Harry Washington, who'd left Mount Vernon years before to join Dunmore as resident, managed to reach New York City, where he boarded the British ship L'Abondance, bound for Nova Scotia. A clerk noted his departure in a ledger called the Book of Negroes, listing the 2,775 runaway black men, women, and children who were evacuated from the city with the British that summer. Harry Washington, 43, fine fellow, formerly the property of George Washington, left him 7 years ago. When Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, 60,000 loyalists raced to get behind British lines, knowing their property would be seized if it hadn't been already, or that they themselves would be seized as someone else's property. They chose to leave the United States for Britain or for other parts of its empire. They headed to New York, Savannah, or Charleston, cities still held by the British, and from which they would soon be disembarking. Out of 9,127 loyalists who sailed from Charleston, 5,327 were fugitive slaves. In Virginia, the 2,000 black soldiers under Cornwallis's command who had survived the siege, described as herds of Negroes, trudged through swamps and forests in hopes of reaching a British warship that Washington, under the terms of the surrender, had agreed to allow to sail to New York. They suffered from exhaustion, they suffered from hunger, they suffered from disease. Of 30 people who escaped Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, 15 died of smallpox before reaching Cornwallis. Other fugitive slaves fled to the French. "We gained a veritable harvest of domestics," wrote one surprised French officer. Armed slave patrols pursued the fugitives, capturing hundreds of Cornwallis's soldiers and their families, including two people owned by Washington and five owned by Jefferson. In the race to reach British lines, pregnant women ran too, in hopes that their newborns would earn their freedom papers in the form of a BB certificate, born free behind British lines. Reaching New York or Charleston or Savannah was only the beginning of the journey. In New York, Boston King, a runaway from South Carolina, heard a rumor that all the slaves in the city, some 2,000, were to be delivered up to their masters, and he was haunted by fear of American slave owners marching through the city, seizing upon their slaves in the streets or dragging them out of their beds. King, a carpenter, wrote in his memoirs that blacks in the city were too frightened even to sleep. A Hessian officer reported that as many as 5,000 slave owners entered the city to recapture their slaves. George Washington had in fact ordered the keeping of the Book of Negroes so that owners might later seek compensation for slaves carried off in British ships. In Charleston, soldiers patrolled the wharves to hold back the hundreds of people desperately seeking to realize what would be, for most of them, their last chance at securing the blessings of liberty for themselves and their posterity. Despite the patrols, dozens of people leapt off the docks and swam out to the last longboats heading to the British warships, including the aptly named Free Britain. The swimmers grabbed at the rails of the crowded boats and tried to climb aboard. When they would not let go, the British soldiers on the boats tried to hack off their fingers. The revolution was at its most radical in the challenge it presented to the institution of slavery, and at its most conservative in its failure to meet that challenge. Still, the institution had begun to break, like a pane of glass streaked with cracks but not yet shattered. In January 1783, when Lafayette heard that the commissioners in Paris were near to arriving at a peace treaty, he wrote to Washington to congratulate him, and to propose that together they finish the work the revolution had begun. "Let us unite in purchasing a small estate where we may try the experiment to free the Negroes," he suggested. "Such an example as yours might render it to a general practice, and if we succeed in America, they could bring the experiment to the West Indies." "I should be happy to join you in so laudable a work," Washington wrote back, saying that he wished to meet to discuss the details. No thinking person was unaffected by the challenge the struggle for liberty posed to the institution of slavery, America's Achilles heel. In Philadelphia, in 1783, James Madison, leaving Congress, was packing up, preparing to return to Montpelier. He wasn't sure what to do about Billy, a 23-year-old man he'd brought with him from Virginia when he'd first come to serve in Congress. Billy had been Madison's property since his birth in 1759, when Madison was 8 years old. In 1777, the Pennsylvania legislature passed the first abolition law in the Western world, decreeing that any child born to an enslaved woman after March 1, 1780 would be free after 28 years of slavery, and banning the sale of slaves. New York's John Jay declared that to oppose emancipation would be to find of America that her prayers to heaven for liberty will be impious. In 1782, the Virginia legislature passed a law that allowed slave owners to free their slaves. One Virginia Quaker said, upon manumitting his slaves, that he had been fully persuaded that freedom is the natural right of all mankind, and that it is my duty to do unto others as I would desire to be done by in the like situation. Not many followed his lead. In 1782, Madison had bought a cache of books in Philadelphia, including a copy of Hobbes's Leviathan, even though short of cash and complaining that he would soon be under the necessity of selling a Negro, meaning Billy. The terrible irony of the man who would draft the Constitution selling a man to buy philosophy was prevented by the terms of Pennsylvania's 1780 abolition law. Madison could not, in fact, sell Billy in Philadelphia. And in 1783, as he prepared to leave Philadelphia for Virginia, it was by no means certain, under Pennsylvania law, that he had any legal right to force Billy to go with him either. "I have judged it most prudent not to force Billy back to Virginia, even if it could be done," Madison reported to his father. "I am persuaded his mind is too thoroughly tainted to be a fit companion for fellow slaves in Virginia." That is, Billy, having spent 3.5 years serving Madison in Philadelphia, a city where many black people were free, would be a problem on a plantation. He would incite rebellion. Trade in slaves was illegal in Pennsylvania. Madison might have tried to smuggle Billy out of the state to sell him farther south or to the Caribbean, but, he told his father, he was unwilling to think of punishing him by transporting him merely for coveting that liberty for which we have paid the price of so much blood and have proclaimed so often to be the right and worthy pursuit of every human being. In the end, Madison decided to sell him, not as a slave, but as an indentured servant with a 7-year term. Billy, renamed himself William Gardner, served out his 7-year term, became a free man, worked as a merchant's agent, and raised a family with a wife who, when Jefferson was in Philadelphia, washed Jefferson's clothes. Gardner found his freedom in Philadelphia. Other men and women met more clouded fates. Nearly 30,000 loyalists had sailed from New York to Nova Scotia, among them Harry Washington. Washington settled in Nova Scotia with some 1,500 families, the largest free black community in North America, where they flocked around a Methodist preacher named Moses Wilkinson and a Baptist named David George. But living alongside 1,200 black slaves brought to Nova Scotia by white loyalists, the free black community faced continuing challenges. "The white people were against me," George reported. After he attempted to baptize a white man and woman, a white mob tackled him on his pulpit. "It is known by experience that these persons brought up in servitude and slavery want the assistance and protection of a master to make them happy," wrote one white Nova Scotian, free blacks. Swindlers took over their land allotments, selling off the black men's ground, as one surveyor observed with dismay, without even a shadow of a license. The free black community began to wither. Many of the poor people were compelled to sell their best gowns for 5 pounds of flour in order to support life. When they had parted with all their clothes, even to their blankets, several of them fell down dead in the streets through hunger, Boston King reported. Some killed and ate their dogs and cats. It was as terrible a disaster as Jamestown. While American exiles struggled to survive in Canada, Benjamin Franklin was in Paris, negotiating the terms of the peace. "A great work indeed you have done. God be praised," his sister Jane wrote to him. In September 1783, the American delegation signed the Treaty of Paris. Britain agreed to recognize the independence and sovereignty of the United States. The Americans agreed to make good on debts to British creditors. There were arrangements made for loyalists and their property, and for the release of prisoners of war. Spain and France were largely cut out of the negotiations and got very little from them, while Britain ended up with a very different and more far-flung empire than it had had in 1775. The terms of the peace cut the number of African slaves in Britain's empire in half, which meant that the anti-slavery movement in England gained a more attentive audience, and the pro-slavery lobby was vastly weakened. Quite the reverse applied in the United States. In the aftermath of the American Revolution, slave owners in states like South Carolina gained political power, while slave owners in the West Indies lost it. West Indian planters were outraged by Britain's decision to forbid trade between the islands and the United States, a decision that led to riots. A sizable number of the freed slaves who left the United States for other parts of the British Empire ended up in the Caribbean. In Jamaica, they began demanding the right to vote. They argued that taxation without representation was tyranny. In the end, the American challenge to empire contributed to a political and moral critique of slavery that was felt far more deeply in the British Empire than in the United States. The peace made, George Washington rode on a gray horse into the city of New York, where a flag of 13 stripes and stars had been raised on a pole in Battery Park. Only hours before, the British flag had waved. The last British troops had left the city, occupied since 1776, the last British ship not quite out of sight. The city erupted in jubilation as Washington and his soldiers rode down Broadway. That night, Washington went to a tavern for a public dinner, where he raised his wine glass and offered 13 toasts to the new nation, to liberty, to America's allies, and more. To the memory of those heroes who have fallen for our freedom. And may America be an asylum to the persecuted of the earth. And finally, may the remembrances of the day be a lesson to princes. England would have no slaves, and America would have no king. Chapter 4. The Constitution of a Nation. James Madison, 36, bookish and wise, reached Philadelphia on May 3, 1787, 11 days before the Constitutional Convention was meant to begin. He settled into his old rooms at Mrs. House's Hotel, a boarding house on Fifth and Market Streets, where he'd stayed during meetings of the Continental Congress. To prepare for the convention, he reviewed his notes on the construction of republics. George Washington arrived on May 13th, on the eve of the convention, not nearly as quietly, greeted by crowds, the pealing of church bells, a regiment of cavalry, and a 13-gun salute. When Washington reached Mrs. House's, where he'd planned to stay, the wealthy Philadelphia merchant Robert Morris met him there and insisted that Washington stay at his lavish mansion a few blocks away. The next morning, Washington and Madison walked together to the Pennsylvania State House through a tender mist. Very few of the delegates had arrived. "There is less punctuality in the outset than was to be wished," Madison wrote to Jefferson in Paris on May 15th, brooding. Delay or no delay, from the start of the proceedings, Madison took careful notes, certain of the value of such a contribution to the fund of materials for the history of a constitution on which would be staked the happiness of a young people. Past an arched doorway in the assembly room of the State House, its tall windows flooding the room with light, the convention met from May 14th to September 17th, from a season of planting to a season of harvest. Madison didn't miss a single day, "nor more than a casual fraction of an hour in any day," he explained, "so that I could not have lost a single speech, unless a very short one." Madison spoke softly and haltingly, the very opposite of the way he wrote. He was making a record for himself, and he was also writing down what happened in Philadelphia that summer for Jefferson. Ever since Jefferson left the country in 1784, Madison had been taking notes of congressional deliberations for him, too. But Madison understood that, above all, he was making a record for posterity, a record of how a constitution had come to be written. To constitute something is to make it. A body is constituted of its parts, a nation of its laws. "The constitution of man is the work of nature," Rousseau wrote in 1762. "That of a state is a work of art." By the 18th century, a constitution had come to mean that assemblage of laws, institutions, and customs derived from certain fixed principles of reason according to which the community hath agreed to be governed. Englishmen boasted that England is now the only monarchy in the world that can properly be said to have a constitution. But England's constitution is unwritten. Instead of a single written document, England's constitution is the sum of its laws, customs, and precedents. In a debate with the conservative Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine suggested that England's constitution did not, in fact, exist. "Can then Mr. Burke produce the English constitution?" Paine asked. "If he cannot, we may fairly conclude that though it has been so much talked about, no such thing as a constitution exists or ever did exist." In America's book of Genesis, the constitution would be written, printed, and preserved. Centuries of speculation about a state of nature, a time before government, came to an end. It was no longer necessary to imagine how a people might erect a government. This could be witnessed. We have no occasion to roam for information into the obscure field of antiquity, nor hazard ourselves upon conjecture, Paine wrote. We are brought at once to the point of seeing government begin, as if we had lived in the beginning of time. It was with this in mind that Madison proved so careful a historian. It was as if he were living at the beginning of time. 1. The Constitution of the United States was not the first written constitution in the history of the world. The world's first written, popularly ratified constitutions were drafted by the American states, beginning in 1776. Having dismantled their own governments, they took seriously, literally, the idea that they needed to create them anew, as if they had been returned to a state of nature. Three states had adopted written constitutions even before Congress declared independence from England, because they found themselves otherwise without a government. "We conceive ourselves reduced to the necessity of establishing a form of government," a constitutional Congress convened in New Hampshire declared in January 1776, after the loyalist governor of New Hampshire fled the state, along with most members of his council. 11 of the 13 states devised constitutions in 1776, or 1777. The work of writing these constitutions, Jefferson noted in 1776, was the whole object of the present controversy. Most state constitutions were drafted by state legislatures. Others were written by men elected as delegates to special conventions. In the spring of 1775, the irascible John Adams had urged Congress to recommend to the people of every colony to call such conventions immediately and set up governments of their own under their own authority, for the people were the source of all authority and the original of all power. New Hampshire had been the first to act. It was the first state to submit its constitution to the people for ratification, a process whose outcome was far from inevitable. In 1778, when the Massachusetts legislature drafted a constitution and presented it to the people for ratification, the people rejected it and called for a special convention, which was held in Cambridge in 1779. Adams, one of its delegates, was the chief author of a new constitution that the people of Massachusetts ratified in 1780. That this act, the people voting on the very form of government, represented an extraordinary break with the past, was not lost on Adams, he wrote. "How few of the human race have ever enjoyed an opportunity of making an election of government, more than of air, soil, or climate, for themselves or their children." Each of the states was a laboratory, each new constitution, another political experiment. Many state constitutions, like those of Virginia and Pennsylvania, included a Declaration of Rights. Pennsylvania's, written in September 1776, began by echoing the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, establishing that all men are born equally free and independent and have certain natural, inherent, and inalienable rights, amongst which are the enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Massachusetts' constitution insisted on a right to revolution, decreeing that when the government fails the people have a right to alter the government and to take measures necessary for their safety, prosperity, and happiness. For all the veneration of the people, the word democracy retained an unequivocally negative connotation. 18th-century Americans borrowed from Aristotle the idea that there are three forms of government, a monarchy, an aristocracy, and a polity. Governments by the one, the few, and the many. Each becomes corrupt when the government seeks to advance its own interests rather than the common good. A corrupt monarchy is a tyranny, a corrupt aristocracy is an oligarchy, and a corrupt polity, a democracy. The way to avoid corruption is to properly mix these three forms so that corruption in any one would be restrained or checked by the others. between a government too monarchical and a government too democratic, Massachusetts lawyer and later member of Congress Fisher Ames would rather have had the former. Monarchy is like a merchantman which sails well, but will sometimes strike on a rock and go to the bottom, Ames wrote in 1783, whilst a republic is a raft which would never sink, but then your feet are always in the water. Unlike the harumphing Ames, many of the people who were drafting state constitutions apparently preferred to err on the side of democracy. In framing new governments, several states lowered property qualifications for voting. Under the terms of Pennsylvania's new constitution, any man who had lived in the state for a year and paid taxes, any taxes, could vote. Where earlier two-thirds of white men could vote, 90% now could. Yet many men of means found this development alarming, believing that poor men, like women, lacked the capacity to make good political decisions because, dependent on others, their will was not their own. Massachusetts' constitution included property qualifications, both for office seekers and for voters. As Adams explained, "Such is the frailty of the human heart that very few men who have no property have any judgment of their own." Most states arranged for a government of three branches, with a governor as executive, a superior court as judicial, and a Senate and House of Representatives as legislative. But some states, attempting to correct for colonial arrangements in which a royally appointed governor and his appointed council wielded the preponderance of power over a weak elected assembly, granted the greatest weight to lower houses of the legislature rather than to upper houses or to an executive. Pennsylvania's constitution, like its Quakers, was the most radical, and in the eyes of many observers, alarmingly democratic. It called for annual elections, no governor, and a unicameral legislature whose members served limited terms. Any proposed law had to be printed and distributed to the people, who would have a year to consider it before the legislature voted. The state's constitutions were political experiments in more ways, too. The Declaration of Rights in Vermont's 1777 constitution specifically banned slavery. Men might be indented as servants till the age of 21 or women until the age of 18, but no one past that age could be held in bondage. This provision would have made Vermont the first state to abolish slavery, except that in 1777, Vermont was not a state, but an independent republic. It would not join the United States until 1791. In 1781, Bett, a slave in Massachusetts whose husband had fought and died in the war, filed a suit in which she argued that the state's new constitution had abolished slavery. Bett's owner, John Ashley, was a local judge. She'd heard him talk about natural rights with 26-year-old Theodore Sedgwick, one of his law clerks. When Ashley's wife tried to strike Bett's sister with a kitchen shovel, Bett blocked the blow and was badly burned. Fleeing, she went to Sedgwick and decided, with his help, to sue for her freedom. "All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and find that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness," Adams had written in Article 1 of the Massachusetts Constitution's Declaration of Rights. Citing Adams, Bett won her case and her liberty and gave herself a new name, Elizabeth Freeman. 2 years later, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court formally ruled that slavery was inconsistent with the state's constitution, adding, "Is not a law of nature that all men are equal and free? Is not the laws of nature the laws of God? Is not the law of God, then, against slavery?" The next year, Pennsylvania's 1775 Society for the Relief of Free Negroes Held Unlawfully in Bondage renamed itself the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, and a judge in Vermont ruled in favor of a runaway slave whose master had produced a bill of sale proving his ownership. The judge said that in order to retain his property in the form of another man, he'd have to provide a bill of sale from God Almighty. Inevitably, some state constitutions worked better than others. What clearly didn't work well were the Articles of Confederation, which had been hastily drawn up by the Continental Congress for the purpose of waging war against Britain. And even this they did not do well. Regiments went unfed, soldiers unpaid, veterans unpensioned. Drafted in 1777, the articles weren't ratified by the states until 1781. The delay was the result of the states' competing claims to western land. And even after the articles were adopted, those claims remained largely unresolved. Efforts to revise the articles proved fruitless, even though the Continental Congress had no standing to resolve disputes between states nor any authority to set standards or to regulate trade. The new nation was riddled, as a result, with 13 different currencies and 13 separate navies. Most urgently, Congress lacked the authority to raise money, which it needed both to make good on its debts and to pay for troops in the Northwest Territory, a swath west of the Alleghenies, north of the Ohio River, and east of the Mississippi that the federal government had acquired from the states. The 1783 Treaty of Paris had required that the states repay their debts, and when the states defaulted on those debts, Great Britain threatened to default on a commitment, also made under the terms of the peace, to surrender its northwestern forts, Oswego, Niagara, and Detroit, to the United States. Even if Congress had fully possessed the power to tax, how to calculate the tax burden of each state remained unsettled. Should each state pay in proportion to the size of its population, or in proportion to its property? In much of the country, one kind of property took the form of people. For purposes of taxation, then, would slaves count as people or as property? In 1777, Pennsylvania Samuel Chase had argued that only white inhabitants should count as people, because legally, blacks were no more people than cattle. This point seemed so essential to South Carolina's Thomas Lynch that he had threatened that if it is debated whether their slaves are their property, there is an end to Confederation. Whereupon Benjamin Franklin made the wry observation that there was one plain way to tell the difference between people and property. Sheep will never make any insurrections. In 1781 and again in 1783, Congress tried to revise the Articles so as to grant itself authority to collect taxes on imports. This led to a return to the original debate about how to calculate each state's tax burden, by the number of inhabitants or by the value of the land. The value of the land was difficult to calculate. Acreage alone is a poor guide, since a field is worth more than a swamp. And, as Adam Smith had argued in The Wealth of Nations, the most decisive mark of the prosperity of any country is the increase of the number of its inhabitants. Population seemed both easier to calculate and a more sensible measure, for purposes not only of taxation, but also of representation. This led to a compromise involving a fraction. A committee on revenue proposed that two blacks be rated as equal to one freeman. Other proposals followed, until Mr. Madison said that in order to give proof of the sincerity of his professions of liberality, he would propose that slaves should be rated as 5 to 3. It was very nearly arbitrary, this mathematical formula, that would determine the course of American elections for 7 decades. At the time, it was also moot. It was never implemented because the state legislatures refused to ratify any revenue-raising amendments. But the proposed ratio, 3 to 5, was not forgotten. The Confederation limped along, weak and hobbled. France and Holland pressed for payment of debts, in real money, not in the paper currency on which the Republic floated. Not worth a continental, a phrase used to describe the paper currency printed by Congress, entered the lexicon. Congress was unable to pay its creditors, and by 1786 the Continental government was nearly bankrupt. The states, too, were in distress. They could levy taxes, but they couldn't reliably collect them. Massachusetts had levied taxes to retire the state's war debt. Farmers who failed to pay could have their property seized and auctioned. Many of those farmers had fought in the war, and beginning in August of 1786, they decided to fight again. Well over 1,000 armed farmers in western Massachusetts, angry and alienated and led by a veteran named Daniel Shays, protested the government, blockading courthouses and seizing a federal armory. It seemed as if the infant nation might descend into civil war, beginning an unending cycle of revolution. "I wish our poor, distracted state would attend to the many good lessons of history," Jane Franklin wrote to her brother, "and not keep always in a flame." Madison feared the rebellion would spread all the way to Virginia. Washington began to wonder whether the nation needed a king after all, writing to Madison, "We are fast verging to anarchy and confusion." As Madison reported to Jefferson, Shays' rebellion had tainted the faith of even the most committed Republicans. A last-ditch effort to restore order by revising the Articles of Confederation was scheduled to begin on September 11, 1786, in Annapolis, at a special convention of delegates that included Madison, who had probably been behind the resolution to convene the meeting. To prepare, he threw himself into his reading of political history. He had been assembling a library. In 1785, Jefferson shipped him crates of books from Paris. Since I have been at home, I have had the leisure to review the literary cargo for which I am so much indebted to your friendship, he wrote to Jefferson in March of 1786, reporting that Virginia had had so much snow that winter that the tops of the Blue Ridge Mountains were still white. While the snow melted that spring, Madison composed a long essay called Ancient and Modern Confederacies, an assessment of all the confederated governments he could discover in his readings, their structure, their strengths, and above all, their weaknesses. It had been an unusually wet spring. Madison left Virginia in summer and wended through fields of sodden crops of wheat and rye. He rode all the way to New York on business before turning around to head back down to Maryland, still mulling over his reading and giving Jefferson still more instructions for books he'd like to add to his library. If you meet with Graecorum res publicae ab ubone emeo, descriptae lugdunum batavorum, 1632, pray get it for me, he pressed him. A road-weary Madison arrived in Annapolis in September, vastly discouraged. So frayed was the spirit of union, and so weak was the federal government, that delegates from only 5 of the 13 states turned up for the convention. They met at George Mann's Tavern, a 6-gabled brick hotel. Madison stabled his horse in Mann's barn. Without anything close to a quorum, 12 men from 5 states agreed to a resolution drafted by Alexander Hamilton of New York that delegates, ideally from all 13 states, would gather in Philadelphia the next year to devise such further provisions as shall appear to them necessary to render the Constitution of the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union. If more delegates had turned up for the Annapolis Convention, they'd most likely have proposed a single amendment to the Articles, granting Congress the authority to raise revenue. The bad turnout, ironically, opened the possibility for more sweeping action. Still, when the resolution reached Congress, which met then in New York, Congress failed for weeks to consider it. Arguably, it was only the course of events in Massachusetts that spurred Congress to act. In January 1787, the governor of Massachusetts sent a 3,000-man militia across the state in an attempt to suppress Shays' rebellion and regain the federal armory, all of this without any authority from the federal government. The state instituted martial law. In New York, Congress finally acted, approving of the proposed Philadelphia Convention for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. No one said anything about drafting a constitution. After Annapolis, Madison went home to Virginia and resumed his course of study. In April of 1787, he drafted an essay called Vices of the Political System of the United States. It took the form of a list of 11 deficiencies, beginning with 1. Failure of the states to comply with the constitutional requisitions. 2. Encroachments by the states on the federal authority. 3. Violations of the law of nations and of treaties. And it closed with a list of causes for these vices, which he located primarily in the people themselves. By this last, he meant the danger that a majority posed to a minority. In Republican government, the majority, however composed, ultimately give the law. Whenever, therefore, an apparent interest or common passion unites a majority, what is to restrain them from unjust violations of the rights and interests of the minority, or of individuals? What force restrains good men from doing bad things? Honesty, character, religion, these, history demonstrated, were not to be relied upon. No, the only force that could restrain the tyranny of the people was the force of a well-constructed constitution. It would have to be as finely wrought as an iron gate. 2. Benjamin Franklin, who was not done with his usefulness, spent the early days of May 1787 waiting for the laggard delegates to arrive and attending to his correspondence. His sister Jane wrote from Boston that she'd been reading about him. "I want to tell you how much pleasure I enjoy in the constant and lively mention made of you in the newspapers," she wrote, full of pride. Franklin was 81 years old. Jane was 74. "The news of his flurry of activity," she told him, winking, "makes you appear to me like a young man of 25. Franklin was the oldest of the 75 men who had been elected to represent 12 states at the convention. Rhode Island, unwilling to grant the necessity of the meeting, refused to send a delegation. Half of the delegates were lawyers. 19 delegates owned slaves. Only 55 showed up, and since they came and went, there were usually only about 30 men on hand on any given day. When on May 14th, the day the convention was to begin, hardly any of the delegates had arrived, Madison blamed the weather. Aside from Franklin and Madison, two more members of the Pennsylvania delegation, Gouverneur Morris and James Wilson, were already in town. And so were two more members of the Virginia delegation, George Washington and Edmund Randolph. These six men met on the night of May 16th at Franklin's newly enlarged house, its growth a measure of his own rise. As he explained to his sister, he'd built an addition and installed a door in his bedroom by which he could enter directly into his library, even in slippers and robe. "When I look at these buildings, my dear sister, and compare them with that in which our good parents educated us, the difference strikes me with wonder," he wrote to her, remembering the tiny wooden house on the crooked street of Boston where they'd been born, in a smaller America. That night, by the light of candles in Franklin's dining room, the six early comers to the convention agreed that, instead of merely revising the articles, which were little more than a treaty of alliance among sovereign states, the convention ought to devise a national government. The next day, Madison set to work drafting what became known as the Virginia Plan. Franklin returned to his correspondence. "We are all well, and join in love to you and yours," he wrote to his sister. He pondered the state of the Union. His sister had one piece of advice. "I hope with the assistance of such a number of wise men as you are connected with in the convention, you will gloriously accomplish and put a stop to the necessity of dragooning and haltering. They are odious means," she wrote, urging her brother to support an end to the draft and capital punishment. "I had rather hear of the swords being beat into plowshares and the halters used for cart ropes, if by that means we may be brought to live peaceably with one another." Franklin's sister, like so many Americans, had suffered gravely during the war. She'd lost her home. One of her sons had died of wounds suffered during the Battle of Bunker Hill. Another had gone mad. She'd had enough of guns and violence. Franklin tucked her letter away and governed his tongue. The convention began its work 11 days late on May 25th, when at last a quorum of 29 delegates had arrived. Washington, almost as striking at 55 as he'd been as a young man, was unanimously elected president. His beauty was marred only by his terrible teeth, which had rotted and been replaced by dentures made from ivory and from 9 teeth pulled from the mouths of his slaves. Deeply and nearly universally admired, Washington represented to many Americans all that was noblest in a republic. Nothing better testified to his civic virtue than his resignation of his command at the end of the war. Instead of seizing power, he had given it away. His role as president of the Constitutional Convention was mostly ceremonial, but as with so many ceremonial roles, it was an essential and even a stirring performance. The deliberations began in earnest on May 29th, when Edmund Randolph offered a polite expression of gratitude to the framers of the Articles of Confederation, who could hardly be faulted for that document's deficiencies, given that they had done all that patriots could do in the then infancy of the science of constitutions and of confederacies. Randolph was a formidable lawyer whose loyalist father had fled Virginia in 1775 and whose uncle Peyton's slaves had joined Lord Dunmore's regiment. He knew mayhem. He said he considered the prospect of anarchy from the laxity of government everywhere and offered a series of resolutions about the means available to the convention for avoiding chaos. The immediate problem the delegates were charged with addressing, that chaos, was Congress's debt, its lack of cash, and its inability to raise taxes or to suppress popular revolt or to resolve conflicts between the states. But like many other delegates, Randolph believed that the work of the convention was to counter the tendencies of the state constitutions. "Our chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions," he said. Massachusetts firebrand Elbridge Gerry agreed that the state suffered from an excess of democracy. Randolph believed that the point of the convention was to provide a cure for the evils under which the United States labored, that in tracing these evils to their origin, every man had found it in the turbulence and follies of democracy, that some check, therefore, was to be sought for against this tendency of our governments. Those delegates who opposed establishing a national government and who thought they'd come to Philadelphia to revise the Articles of Confederation could not appeal to the public, which might well have been severely alarmed by word of the goings-on in Independence Hall, had they heard so much as a whisper. The delegates had pledged to keep their deliberations secret, for a term of 50 years, a pledge that worked in favor of men like Madison. And within the hall, it allowed for a full and frank airing of views. The Constitution drafted in Philadelphia acted as a check on the Revolution, a halt to its radicalism. If the Revolution had tilted the balance between government and liberty toward liberty, the Constitution shifted it toward government. But in very many ways, the Constitution also realized the promise of the Revolution, and particularly the promise of representation. In devising the new national government, the delegates adamantly rejected a proposal that the state legislators, rather than the people, elect members of Congress. Under the existing Confederacy, Congress represents the states, not the people of the states, George Mason said. Their acts operate on the states, not on the individuals. The case will be changed in the new plan of government. The people will be represented. They ought, therefore, to choose their representatives. However much delegates at the convention might have railed at the excess of democracy in the state constitutions and regretted the lowering of property qualifications for voting in the states, they did not institute those requirements in the federal constitution. Franklin argued that, since poor men of no estate whatsoever had fought in the war, there could be no sound reason why they should not vote in the new government. "Who are to be the electors of the federal representatives?" Madison asked. "Not the rich more than the poor, not the learned more than the ignorant, not the haughty heirs of distinguished names more than the humble sons of obscure and unpropitious fortune. The electors are to be the great body of the people of the United States." This was a matter as much of politics as of principle. Connecticut delegate Oliver Ellsworth put it plainly. "The people will not readily subscribe to the national constitution if it should subject them to be disenfranchised." Voting requirements were left to the states. Nor did the Constitution institute property requirements for running for federal office. "Who are to be the objects of popular choice?" Madison asked. "Every citizen whose merit may recommend him to the esteem and confidence of his country." What could be more revolutionary than these words? "No qualification of wealth, of birth, of religious faith, or of civil profession is to be permitted to fetter the judgment or disappoint the inclinations of the people," Madison insisted. In this same revolutionary spirit, the Constitution required congressmen to be paid so that the office would not be limited to wealthy men. It required only a short residency for immigrants before they, too, became eligible to run for office. Delegates who argued for greater restriction faced immigrants like Hamilton, born in the West Indies, and James Wilson, born in Scotland, who wondered at the prospect of his being incapacitated from holding a place under the very Constitution which he had shared in the trust of making. But if these matters were resolved with relative ease, others proved far more difficult. The convention found itself facing a nearly unbreachable divide. How was fairly apportioned representation in Congress to be achieved in a national government composed of states of such different sizes? One proposal involved redrawing the map of the United States. "Lay the map of the Confederation on the table," a New Jersey delegate suggested, "and redraw it so that all the existing boundaries be erased and that a new partition of the whole be made up of 13 equal parts." But as Madison pointed out, the problem wasn't only the size of the states. It was the nature of their population. "The states were divided into different interests, not by the difference of their size," he explained, "but principally from the effects of their having or not having slaves." The problem of property in the form of people had become an even bigger problem than it had been before the Revolution. The years following the end of the war had witnessed the largest importation of African slaves to the Americas in history, 1 million people over a single decade. The slave population of the United States, 500,000 in 1776, had soared to 700,000 by 1787. After the Treaty of Paris, when Britain recognized the independence of the United States, it also regarded its former colonies as a foreign nation, which meant that American merchants were banned from British ports, including ports in the West Indies. As a result, a trade in slaves grew within the United States, as slave owners in the South sold their property to backcountry settlers in Kentucky, Louisiana, and Tennessee. Yet even as the number of slaves in the Southern states was rising, it was falling in the North. By 1787, slavery had been effectively abolished in New England and much challenged in Pennsylvania and New York. Economically, it was significant in only 5 of the 13 states, and in only 2, South Carolina and Georgia, was it the crux of the economy. At the convention, it proved impossible to set the matter of slavery aside, both because the question of representation turned on it and because any understanding of the nature of tyranny rested on it. When Madison argued about the inevitability of a majority oppressing a minority, he cited ancient history and told of how the rich oppressed the poor in Greece and Rome, but he cited too modern American history. We have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most